and gentlemen, it's the Stephanie Miller Show.
Paul Ryan gets a hero's welcome when he returns to the House today. They're just cheering him, those Republicans.
Oh, are they really? Wow.
Yeah, it's part of his Don't Quit Your Day Job tour. And guess what? Turns out he's not quitting his day job.
No.
Good morning. I'm John Fugel saying welcome to the Stephanie Miller Show. I've had such a blast filling in all week, as I was just saying, the Jackie Schechter. I've had as much fun this week doing this show as Mitt Romney has had no fun this week being Mitt Romney. And I thank you very much for joining us all week long. Today, we have very special guests. I'm trying to find good fanfare music to play for you guys. Well, that's almost good enough without quite being good.
A little too macho.
A little too butch for you. Well, hey, listen, back in the driver's seat, I have two guys who were here earlier in the week on separate days here together. Please welcome this unholy alchemy. First off, Trevon Free, what a pleasure to have you here.
Oh, it's always great to be here.
Great to have you back, sir. I'm sorry that I called you Trevon Martin earlier this morning. That never happens.
You and like 1,000 other people on Twitter for like 3 months.
Well, so. you're to us white people, your names all sound alike.
Yeah,
you know
exactly.
That, right? Okay. And of course, over in the passenger side, the one, the only, the legendary. First he was TV's Frank, now he's TV on the radio's Frank. It's Frank Conniff.
That's more like it, yeah.
Terrific.
Great to be here, and I forgive you for calling me Jeffrey Dahmer.
I'm so sorry. It's just you look so similar, and you do keep body parts in your fridge. Well,
yes,
so
I do, and I'm not a vegetarian in the least bit.
And, of course, on the mic, as always, it's Silent Tony, Tony Sorrentino. How are you, Tony?
There you go.
Anything? Nothing. Steph's box isn't working. Is this happening at a certain point?
It seems like
I don't understand. It seems like her box is not as sensitive. And there you go. That one works.
Wow.
Well, sometimes you can never tell when her box is going to be.
Can't believe how dirty this show is already.
Yeah,
it's the best kind of show right there.
Well, sometimes, Frank, you see what happens is when a radio show host has her box here being used by strangers for a long time, it becomes less sensitive and less responsive to touch when you hit the right buttons.
I think because most of the time it's not men using her box.
Indeed. And I'm here coming in here with my crude
testosterone. We don't know how to work it.
I don't understand the intricacies of it. It's a complex computer, and I'm just a crude, vulgar guy who doesn't know how to press the right buttons. Good morning to all those of you who've already
left. For those of you just tuning in, we're talking about her vagina.
No, we're not. How dare you? We're doing quite the opposite. Now, it's been quite a week, gentlemen. Mitt Romney, you know, here's the thing. I'm getting some flack for being too nice to Mitt Romney.
Really?
Well, and then Republicans say I'm just too mean to him and I'm not mean enough to the president. I don't want to be too mean to Mitt Romney. I'm trying to find good things to say about Governor Romney every day. He makes it really difficult. Governor Romney has had a problem with lying on this tour, and this campaign, listen to me. And
he's on the not very sexy conservative tour.
Yes, he's on the considerably frigid conservative tour. In an interview with ABC News Thursday evening, Republican presidential nominee Mitt Romney suggested that after all was said and done, the Obama administration concluded his criticisms of their handling of yesterday's embassy attacks was valid. Mitt Romney said, what I said was exactly the same conclusion the White House reached, which was that the statement was inappropriate. That's why they backed away from it as well. He's just making stuff up. This is reported here. This is fairly impressive verbal gymnastics. Yes, the White House distanced itself from the initial statement put out by the U.S. Embassy in Cairo. And yes, Romney also criticized the issuance of that statement. But Romney also accused the president of sympathizing with the rioters because of the initial statement.
Well, first of all, he's using the same twisted pretzel logic he used when he was talking about how the auto bailout was his idea all along.
Exactly.
You know, it's the same thing. And also, it's pretty reprehensible that who he's really criticizing is the people in the embassy who are under siege and who are putting out a tweet to try to diffuse the situation, and it didn't work. But I saw Laura Ingraham on Bill O'Reilly last night doing the exact same thing, demonizing the people who are just like our troops who are serving their country overseas,
and
talking about how weak they came off, putting out this tweet, and Laura Ingraham from her comfortable perch not very in any safe. Kind of danger. These brave people who work in embassies
exactly.
and are serving their country and for political purposes get demonized by people like Laura Ingraham and Mitt Romney.
If you let's say you've been kind of in a haze or passed out or this entire week or you're Amanda Bynes and you're just waking up. And here's how it works. Earlier this week, of course, we still don't know if the attacks. On September 11th, this past Tuesday, were coordinated, if they were pre-planned, or if it was just a spontaneous response to this disgusting anti-Muslim film that has been made by seemingly no one. Mm. Apparently, this movie was made in a vacuum, and all the actors deny that they had anything to do with it, and the guy who made it said he didn't make it. And so a large congregation of angry Egyptians gathered outside our embassy, and someone inside the embassy, in a frightened state, completely unauthorized, released a statement, not a tweet, saying how they condemned this film and anything that's done to insult and hurt the feelings of Muslims. By 10 o'clock that night, again, this is September 11th, the White House issued a statement saying that they did not authorize that statement, that someone did it on their own, and they had no permission. It was one frightened embassy staffer trying to defuse a potentially ugly situation.
And Romney is putting that all on the Obama. It's a sign of the weakness of the Obama administration.
It's dirtier than that, Frank, because the Obama campaign and Romney campaign had an unspoken, decided upon deal to not do negative advertising on September 11th.
Right.
Good for them both. So the Romney
campaign.
Yeah,
we were talking about that that morning.
Uh huh. The Romney campaign put out their statement that the president was sympathizing with the attackers at 10 p.m. in an email blast to reporters.
Right, and tried to pull it back, right?
The caveat that they couldn't run it until midnight. So he released it on 9/11, just said, you can't publish it until after 9/11 to show what a good guy I am. Which would be sleazy on its own a little bit, except for the fact that it's a lie. And the president never did any such thing. The White House immediately disavowed these statements. So, of course, we know what happened later on. The embassy was stormed. No one was hurt, thank God. They did climb up and take down the American flag and hang up another flag. And, of course, we know what happened later on in Libya and the tragic loss of these four diplomats. So that's the timeline we're working with here. Governor Romney has since doubled down on this lie in his smirking press conference to make him look presidential with his nice little set. He should go, if you really want to look presidential, Mitt Romney, seriously, chop brush. Seriously, go down to Texas and find a fake ranch that you don't actually live at, with no horses or livestock, and just cut brush. It really works with the base. I can't explain why, but it makes them think you're presidential. So we have this happening, and now, of course, they're saying, and Reince Priebus, RNCPRBS.
My favorite peanut butter cup.
And again, all men over 50, get your Reince Priebus's check every 6 months. Reince Priebus said that the president was sympathizing with the attackers and called it sad and pathetic.
Yes, I saw that.
I'm not waiting for an apology. If he was a man, he'd resign.
Yes. Or if the Republicans were men, they'd force him to resign.
Indeed. I completely agree with you. It trivializes the murder of these diplomats. This man, Ambassador Stevens, who gave his life for Libya, who risked his life for Libya time and time again to help these people become free. There have already been some people picked up for questioning, and I have no doubt the new governing authority of Libya really, really doesn't want to endanger their strategic partnership with the United States. There will be arrests made for this crime. I'm sure of it. So we've had this lie, and now Mitt Romney is doubling down on it yet again and accused the president of sympathizing with the rioters because of the initial statement, despite the fact the embassy released it unauthorized one employee hours before the attacks even took place. And then the White House retracted it and walked back on it and from this piece. And while Romney may want to focus attention elsewhere, it was that specific attack on Obama that had Democrats, foreign policy experts, and a good chunk of Republicans criticizing his conduct. Stephanopoulos asked Romney about it during the interview, and he seemingly avoided the substance of the issue.
Mitt Romney, really?
Yes, and the substance is, does Obama sympathize with the rioters? All Mitt Romney said to Stephanopoulos was, well, I think the statement was an appropriate statement. I think it was not directly applicable and appropriate for the setting. I think it should have been taken down, and apparently the White House felt the same way. So this guy is just—he's just so oily.
He
repels snake oil. Is what happens if you try to put snake oil on Mitt Romney, it bounces off.
He
like
makes
Teflon.
Us miss the moral clarity of Newt Gingrich and Herman Cain.
Right? I wish we had Herman Cain.
Oh, do I wish we had Herman Cain?
How does somebody like Romney, like, how does he live with himself? Like every day, it's almost like. Who's run? You think on a daily basis, who's running this campaign that the things that get out and the things that get said, the things that come out of his mouth get said to the public?
I have a theory on that, Trevon. My theory is that he doesn't really think about the issues. He's not guided by any kind of passion.
No.
He's guided by the White Horse Principle that he is going to be the Mormon that takes the White House and brings his church into the new era. It's really more hubristic. I think he has one goal that he has never wavered from. He has never flip-flopped from wanting to be president in his entire career since high school. If you read about his life.
His dad ran for president.
His dad ran for president. Mom ran for Senate. His dad, of course, who would probably not be welcome in today's Republican Party.
No.
And his dad, who released 12 years of tax returns.
Who started the tradition.
You're embarrassing me. I'm not going to release Indy.
Romney just seems so broken inside to me, you know, that he's probably a really intelligent guy.
He is.
He's just has no principles to stand on. It's just pure ambition, and that it's a sad thing to watch.
It's really sad, and that's why I keep trying to find something nice to say about the guy, because it's just at this point it's just turning into Dole without the charisma. You know, they're making him run so much further to the right than he wants to run.
Well, someone like Dole seems so substantial compared to Ron. I mean,
Dole is substantial compared to Ron.
Bob
Dole never outsourced anybody's jobs.
Right, and he made independent decisions, and he. Served in World War II, you know, which he wasn't in France, you know, turning people into Mormons.
Neither was Mitt. Mitt was in France being turned down to turn people into Mormons. Well, Mitt was actually, when he was doing his mission in France, was considered the best one of all the young Mormons converting. And the reason they believed that and made Mitt their point man when they would go around Bordeaux, France, trying to convince French people in Bordeaux to stop drinking wine and become Mormons. The reason why they thought Mitt was so good at it was that he had spent part of his formative years in Michigan, and that made his social skills so much better, because the other guys had really lived in a bubble, and Mitt's French was quite fluid. You won't be hearing that on the campaign trail.
No.
It's going to be great. We also have this Mitt Romney marijuana thing that I want to talk about today that we began touching on yesterday.
Oh, I hadn't heard about this.
The medical marijuana issue, but I want to take a few calls right off the bat once we come back from break. So we're at 1-800-STEPH-12. I'm John Fugelsang. We'll be taking your calls all day. Lots to talk about, from the Paul Ryan marijuana controversy. President Morsi in Egypt. I personally loved him with the Smiths, not so much now. And Rush Limbaugh saying that Al-Qaeda gave up bin Laden to make Obama look good. Mm-hmm. It's mayor of crazy town. We want you to stick with us all morning. This is the Stephanie Miller Show. I'm John Fugelsang on your radio, your computer, and on Current TV. Right back.
If you turn her on, she'll turn you on.
Oh, God.
It's the Stephanie Miller Show.
The Beatles and Hanson. What you gonna do about it? I'm John Fugelsang, and this is the Stephanie Miller Show. Good golly, we have missed Stephanie all week. She'll be back here on Monday, taking care of you guys again. But if you all or y'all have had such a horrible week of missing Steph, and you just can't wait until Monday for your Stephanie Miller fix, allow me to recommend to you the best thing you're going to see on TV all weekend. Current TV has done a documentary on the Sexy Liberal Comedy Tour. Nice. It was filmed in Madison, Wisconsin, Columbus, Ohio, and Boston, Massachusetts. Very impressive shoot, by the way. And that's going to air tonight at 9 p.m. on Current TV.
Right.
It features Stephanie, I'm in it, Hal Sparks is in it, Aisha Tyler's in it, tons of the fans are in it, and I've seen some of the footage. It's really, really dynamite. It'll give you a tiny, tiny idea of what it's like to be in the audience for a Stephanie Miller show without actually having Stephanie give you a lap dance, which happens to the first three rows every night of the tour.
I was there.
You were there. You saw it, Trevor.
I saw it.
I mean,
that really happens.
Yeah, you will actually be scraping Stephanie DNA off you when you leave the theater. I mean, that's a VIP package.
She takes care of you.
Yes, she does. She'll love you a long time. So that's tonight. Please watch that. And let's go to your calls right now, because we're going to be taking Dino Badal in a few minutes. I want to get a Muslim's perspective on what's going on here. But first, Janice is calling from Los Angeles. Good morning, Janice. You have a comment on Governor Romney?
Good morning. Last night, my son, my sixth grade son, told me that he's running for president of his school. And so my husband and I were like, oh, that's so cool. What are your issues? What do you care about? And he's like, I don't know. I just want to be president. And so I turned to my husband, kind of like Romney, but my husband had the best line. He looked back at me and he's like, yeah, it's just on his bucket list. And I thought, that's what it is, right? Brilliant. Can you picture Joe Biden saying, listen, for Barack Obama, being president isn't on his bucket list. It's something he wants to change. So.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you so much for the call.
All right, have a great day.
Hey, good luck to your son, Janice. Maybe he'll be a recess creator. That's great.
Romney's bucket list involves a lot of people kicking the bucket if he gets
it. Yeah, Romney, You know, it's just... I want to say nice things. I want to like him. I want to say nice things about him. He makes it hard. Laura, you're calling from Pennsylvania. Good morning. Laura?
Yes, hi.
Hi, you're on the air.
Good morning to everyone.
Good morning.
Yes. Well, I do campaign for President Obama.
Yay.
And I do have to tell everyone, because the question that's asked of me most of the time is, what is entitlements? Most people don't know. I just want to mention everything that Romney said he was going to do away with. He wasn't going to fix or nothing. So here they go. And this is an insurance plan for everybody who thinks that we want free stuff. We pay for this, and it's just a safety net for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
Social Security is gone. Medicare is gone. I talked to a lady who takes care of Medicaid patients, and she said, what are they going to do? Put them out on the street? It's $3,000 a month just to take care of someone who's got Alzheimer's.
Oh.
She said, and the families are going to have to take them back, and it's going to be very hard for them. They said they're going to break unions, which they started last year. And why are they going to break unions? Their employers do not like that, our companies don't like unions. So they're going to do what Romney does, I would imagine, and hire everybody minimum wage. No one to fight for you.
And don't forget, as Teddy Roosevelt,
minimum wage and no pensions.
As Teddy Roosevelt said, labor has to be organized because capital is organized. You're exactly right. Can I give you a suggestion?
Sure.
Here's my suggestion. Stop calling it entitlements and start calling them earned benefits.
Earned benefits. Okay.
Earned benefits. Use that language to get through to your friends on the fence. Yes,
I do like that better.
Because entitlements, yeah, on the surface, you know, words mean something. If you read the word liberal in the dictionary, it's kind of a nice thing.
Right.
Something we should all aspire to be more like, even if you wrote Republican. That's the dictionary definition of liberal. Same with entitlements. You think entitlements means, oh, I worked for this, I get it.
Mm-hmm.
It's
right.
come to mean something petulant, that you were almost as if you were a millionaire at birth who thinks you should be handed the White House. So stop calling it entitlements.
Entitlement is...
Definitely will.
Thank you so much.
I'm not done.
Oh, please. I can tell. Please, don't let me get in your way.
I'm going to go as fast as I can. Unemployment checks. People, this, you didn't put yourselves out of work. You didn't quit your jobs. They're going to stop you on unemployment checks. And they said you won't have Obama there to bail you out.
Mm-hmm.
Food stamps, welfare, Planned Parenthood, education, loans for students, WICs, a formula for babies.
Testify.
Head Start, FEMA, energy, clean air, safe water.
You're sounding like a Billy Joel song.
Hey, guys, you know what? I'll give you a good laugh. 97 hours a week.
Yeah.
I'm tuned to a set. I get up early in the morning, do all my work. I'm a widow. I'm 72.
Wow.
And I'm so scared that I write everything down that they said since day one.
Well, fantastic.
They're getting rid of clean air. What I said that. Wait a minute.
Yeah.
Research for cancer, Alzheimer's. No more research for diseases.
Laura, do you have a Facebook page or something where you document all your documentations?
I do.
What you want to tell it over the air?
Pardon me?
Well, you want to say your name over the air and get a lot of friends?
Sure.
Where do we find you on Facebook to find your documentations?
Okay.
What's your name? How do we find you on Facebook?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I don't have documentation. My documentation is I write everything down they say.
How about you have cute cat pictures on your Facebook page?
Well, I got to say, if you don't have documentation, you're qualified to work for Paul Ryan on his budget. We got to go to break really soon, but I thank you so much for the call. There is documentation from Addicting Info. An evangelical blogger wrote down every lie Mitt Romney told over a 33-week period. It was a 32-week period. This week it's 616 lies in 33 weeks.
Impressive.
I have posted it on the John Fugelsang page on Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
Not a profile. That's my fan page. So if you go there right now, you'll find the 616 lies. It's bona fide, kids. We'll be right back with Muslim comedian Dino Vidala talking about the Middle East right after this.
such and such. I try to improve my vocabulary. I try to cut out eating meat and dairy. I want to bring back the days of the...
This is the Stephanie Miller Show. I'm John Fugelsang. Really, really honored to be filling in for Steph all week. I love this show. I love Steph. I love her staff. I love her audience. Tony, not so much. But all y'all, the rest of you, I truly do. You're listening to Little Jackie, which is a band made up of Imani Coppola, who had a little hit back in the 90s, and now she made this group, Little Jackie.
They sound great.
To me, it sounds like a Phil Spector made like an all-girl group hip-hop album. It's dynamite stuff. And their first album was called The Stoop. That's what this one's from. Check them out. Okay, we're going to go to the phones right now because we had this guy on yesterday, good friend of mine. I sometimes do an off-Broadway show in New York called Laughing Liberally, which takes a few progressive comedians and lets us go off-Broadway and do a show where we can do the kind of material that would get us banned from the clubs that pay. And so Dino Badala is one of my favorite comedians. Of course, he's a contributor to CNN, writes a lot of stuff for CNN's blog, and we're thrilled to have him back on the Stephanie Miller Show. Good morning, Dean. How's your Sharia law campaign going?
It's going pretty well. You know, though, I just heard a commercial on while I was waiting. You have a commercial for ID theft. And, you know, to be honest, if people really want to inoculate themselves from getting their IDs stolen, convert to Islam.
Really?
A Muslim name like ID. No one's going to try to pretend to be you. My last name is Obidala. It has the word Allah in it. No criminal is going to take a name like that. I mean, I have a friend, I swear, he's Arab American Muslim, born in America. His first name is Osama. He can leave his driver's license and credit card in a crack house. No one's going to want him. So, you can do the identity theft or just convert to Islam and you will be immune to identity theft. This is my sales pitch for Islam.
What happens if you're a Muslim and have your identity stolen? What do you do?
That's really bad. In the Middle East it will happen because there's a lot more Abdullahs and Obidallahs and the name Muhammad is not scary to people. In America, I'm not kidding, if you're a criminal and you have an option between John Reynolds or Abdul Musa Rahman Abdullah, I mean, what name are you going to take? What gets attention? Like, you're like, I'm really going to be this person? No, you're not. So,
even if the Muslim has a great credit score.
On average, our income is higher than the average person. Whatever. You know
I got to tell you something, though. I honestly have in the past stolen Muslim Americans' identity and credit cards.
What?
Well, I've only done it to buy pork in their name. It's just, you know, this vicious thing I do.
Pork and alcohol. They're really
or you can be Mitt Romney and not have an identity to steal.
You're confusing identity with personality, right?
Okay. Is he running for president? Is he still running? I mean, isn't it over? I don't even know why he's running.
You know,
today.
When you
I
have
think he's crawling at this point.
It's really incredible. He called Obama, essentially he said that Obama proved him right. And you know, we've even seen so many Republican foreign policy analysts and experts come out and slam Mitt Romney. Mm-hmm. Peggy Noonan took a break from writing her next Ronald Reagan coffee table book, presumably, to slam him. And, you know, we mentioned earlier how Reince Priebus has said that Obama sympathizes with attackers in Egypt, sad and pathetic. Bob Cheska on the Awesome blog wrote, how does one sympathize with attackers before there are any attackers, especially when 90 minutes earlier the administration condemned the attack
because Romney does things retroactively.
That's right.
So he went back and made him attack the attackers exist.
I think he's actually got that time machine Obama used to place the phony birth announcement in the 1961 Hawaii newspaper. Dean,
but look at the political. Do you see political article by Joe Scarborough yesterday? It's like the number one ranked article on it. Joe Scarborough said that Mitt Romney is going to lose. He said he should lose, and it's actually good for the Republican Party because Mitt Romney's not a true conservative. He's an ambitious man, which is great, but not a good president. Joe Scarborough said this, who, you know, was a Republican congressman. I guess he's kind of moderate today. And
I disagree. I don't think he's a moderate. I think Joe Scarborough's a real conservative. I think that he's one of the guys who stayed constant while his party has gone into a nut house. I really do.
Yeah,
I think
that's part of the reason why I like him, too.
Yeah, you know, I don't agree with a lot of things he says, right, but I respect his consistency. I respect the way he's at. Joe Scarborough is a guy who campaigned door-to-door, knocking on doors for George W. Bush in 2000. I mean, you know, but as the GOP has gone crazier, he has remained a real normal conservative, and he just doesn't hate liberals. He doesn't hate the president, and that he doesn't get blinded by the hate. But he's right, Dean. I think that this is another example of how Mitt Romney is bad for the Republican Party on many levels, from Citizens United allowing him to buy the nomination process, to the fact that, we don't know what his core values are. He's flip-flopped on so many things. He's a human windsock. We call him reversible Republicans. And, you know, I think that he's bad for the brand. That's why at the GOP convention we saw all these guys auditioning for 2016. But right. I want to, including Rand Paul and his hair. Right. But I want to ask you, Dean, about Libya today, because it just seems like things are getting more and more ugly. We know that they're trying to make arrests in Libya for these senseless murders. But I was very encouraged and moved by all the photos that were published on BuzzFeed of Libyans holding up photos saying that how they apologize for these killings, how they want peace, how the terrorists don't speak for them.
It's true. Mitt Romney denounced him for apologizing. How dare you apologize?
I heard Mitt Romney just denounced the Jedi for sympathizing with the Sith, which is...
Hello, geeks. Anti-apology tour. If anyone's ever apologized for anything, he's going around, he's going to go to my ex-girlfriend. Dean didn't. That apology was wrong. He should have apologized to you.
Nice.
But it's... What's going... I mean, that and the images, and I saw the images, not on BuzzFeed, I saw them on Facebook, on newsfeed. People are posting them with Libyans holding up signs. This is not what Islam's about. America, in Libya, has a good relationship, and that the people who now run the government are been emboldened and in a way almost installed by U.S. support and NATO support. So you have that situation. If you look at, like, some of this is media spin, though. Like, I just saw the headline, you know, Yemen erupts, and 2,000 protesters out of 25 million people. I mean, I think people have to look at the numbers of the protesters. They're Kuala Lumpur protests, 50 people. 50 people, but the media covered, literally 50.
I heard that the Cairo protest was not that huge a mob as well.
Kind of was truly symbolic on purpose.
When there's anti-war protests in America, those don't get covered by the media.
Exactly right.
They get pepper sprayed.
Mm-hmm.
Well, these are things that get these are the things that sell papers, and it's a nice narrative. There's no doubt there are protests going on in Egypt. It's very peaceful. If the American ambassador and the American workers there were not killed, it would just be protests in the Middle East. Afghanistan, I just read this morning, early news, only a few hundred protesters in Afghanistan about this. They're usually sent to the streets, and like in Gaza, there's some too, and the Hamas leaders send them to the streets. The few hundred perfunctory protests. The Libya one is really the isolated incident. It looks like more like an al-Qaeda attack than any kind of protest opposing this. And what was really good, the Times had an article today, and I was very happy to see the major Muslim groups like ISNA, the Islamic Society of North America, had a big press event yesterday with a rabbi and Christian leaders denouncing it, saying this has nothing to do with Islam, and you don't see any protests in America. I mean, it's really a political game by people on the far right in their native countries in the Middle East to use this. No different than the far right in America will use emotional issues that move people viscerally into the street on gay marriage or abortion.
Yep.
Not the violent part. I'm not talking about the violent part in Libya. I'm just talking about getting people in the streets, going to Chick-fil-A, whatever it might be, to say we have numbers and we're going to get out there. I want to make clear, I'm not saying they're advocating violence.
Yes. I want to clear that as well. We're not saying that American anti-gay bigots who go to Chick-fil-A are on the same level as we're not saying that our right-wing fundamentalist Christian bigots are on the same level as the Libyan far right-wing.
Our bigots are too lazy for violence.
Yes, that's true. Violence involves burning lean tissue here. But, you know, I'm glad you brought it up, Dean, because I have to say time and time again, this destructive, horrible conflict we find the world in, I really more and more come to believe that it's not a clash of civilizations or cultures. It's our right-wing fundamentalists against their right-wing fundamentalists. The people who think violence is a fine way to solve problems are never liberals. Liberals are always the ones on all sides who don't use violence. And this week has convinced me more than ever that I'm on the side of any Christian, Jew, or Muslim trying to solve our problems without violence. That's my tribe.
You know, that's a great side to be on.
You know what? I think maybe you or Dean could expand on this, but I think the thing that I find disturbing is you have people who are anti-Islam, or Islamophobes, and they do things purposely to provoke that kind of reaction from people like that, from extremists. And then when they react that way, they go, see, look how they're acting. This is why we feel this way. So it's like, how does that even go hand in hand when you're purposely knee-jerking these people to be the people you portray them to be when they're not in the first place?
Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. But they play right in. They know it's going to play not in America. There are no American Muslims protesting any of this, not the cartoons, nothing. This is America. You know, we understand the values this nation's founded upon. Freedom of expression is paramount importance for us, American Muslims, Jews, Christians, atheists, whatever you might be. Freedom of expression is important, even if we hate it. So you don't see American Muslims protesting. Sometimes they put a press release. They don't like it. It's a deplorable video. But that's it. It's a handful of people, a lot of times, frankly, illiterate people, used by leaders in other countries to motivate their base. base to get their base out to show that, hey, look all the power I have. I have 1,000 people in the street today. Can you match that? It's almost like tribal warlords on some level in certain countries. It clearly is tribal warlords in certain countries. Yemen has a big influence of Al-Qaeda right now. So for them to get 2,000 people out just makes a statement. Look, we have Al-Qaeda operatives or sympathizers for extreme Islamic fundamentalism.
Exactly.
In the street. But it's 2,000. That's 25 million. Let's put it in perspective. It's teeny.
And I want to point out, too, Google has blocked the anti-Muslim film. We mentioned the name of it on Tuesday. I'm not going to mention the name of it again. We still don't know if these were, you know, spontaneous outbursts over this film, because Egyptian TV showed parts of it, or if it was a coordinated attack on the anniversary of 9/11.
What I've been hearing is I saw a report that said it's really a coordinated attack. That the protests...
It might not be the film.
Were a kind of a cover for that. That it's coming out
that it was planned.
That it was planned. Yeah.
You know, I do also want to point out that it was President Morsi. We always talk about how, you know, hey, in America, if you're a Christian, then stop hating, right? Stop calling to violence. Don't go shooting doctors. Don't go hating your gay brothers and sisters.
Right.
And President Morsi, again, loved him with the Smiths of Egypt, just did the same exact thing. He issued a statement saying how real Muslims will respect and protect the ambassadors and embassies serving them in their communities.
It was
immense credit,
good.
Yeah. And again, kudos to Google for blocking this film.
Dean,
I mean, it's a hard one. I mean, I'm such an advocate of freedom of expression that I think you should be able to see anything, but there's a line, and this is really close to it, but it's really hard for me to say anything should be censored or blocked. You know, it's really, although we're blocking sodas today, the mayor and council of New York, where I live, blocked big sodas starting in 6 months. No more 16-ounce sodas.
I know. There'll be no more obese people in New York City ever again, and there'll be no more diabetes or heart disease thanks to no more big sodas.
Chris Christie's saying, come over to New Jersey. Everything is supersized over here.
We have soda running. It's like Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory.
We have the Augustus Gloop Mountain Dew fountain ride.
Hey, Dean, do you think Muslims in America are afraid to protest or are more hesitant to protest because of for fear of how they think they might be portrayed by the right or people like that who already tried to demonize them in the first place?
I don't think you're talking about in response to the film or about other issues.
Just in general. Like, I mean, when you see, like, protests anywhere in America, the way people react and the way they respond, and because of how the right wing generally tries to portray Islam or portray Muslims in a negative light, do you think that causes hesitation as a community to have protests and, like, to have civilized disagreements with things like that?
I think it's a good question. I think really for my parents' generation, like my father's an immigrant, and the immigrants who came here would be less likely to stand up for their rights. They just want to get along. They're worried about it. I think the people like myself, the ones born here, who are now understanding the importance of politics, getting involved in the media to define who we are, to counter the haters, I don't think there's a hesitation anymore. And my good friend Asif Manvi, who's Muslim, he's on The Daily Show, says we should do a million Muslim march and not tell anybody in advance. Just have a million Muslims take the streets of New York and just scare people. There'd be no cab service that entire day in New York. We'd bring New York to its knees.
You'd have to march.
But I think we're getting more and more active, and now, I mean, for the first time ever, there's, you know, Keith Ellison and Andre Carson, so two Muslim American congressmen.
They're taking over.
Sharia law. Mm-hmm. The more in there, the more elected officials and judges who are Muslim, and more it defeats the argument that somehow we don't value American values. We don't worship American values. We want to impose Sharia law. It changes with time. It takes time. And what kills me sometimes, you see the Fox News is the only one that still gives two sides to Islamophobia. There's not two sides to anti-Semitism.
Fair point.
There's not two sides to racism. There's no two sides to Islamophobia. Mm-hmm. If you hate Muslims, you're like the Klan and the neo-Nazis. That's what the Southern Poverty Law Center says. That's what the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, says. So why put the Klan on? If you're going to have an issue about blacks, put the Klan on Fox News. Why
I have,
not? Don't
I have Muslim
like
cousins. Yeah, I have Muslim cousins. I'm really behind on hating them. I know I'm supposed to. It's really unfortunate. I have Muslim cousins in Jersey, and I'm so ashamed.
If they really want nobody to see that horribly offensive film, they should put it in the NBC primetime lineup.
Oh, Dean, we're out of time. I got to say, what a pleasure it is to have a roundtable like this with two white guys, a Muslim, a black guy, and a mute for Tony.
Let's all walk into a bar later.
Dean Obadalla, where can people follow you, spread your Sharia law?
On Twitter, a Dean of Comedy, and my tour, I'm going to be a Dean of Comedy, a Dean Obadalla for Vice President, Sacramento, San Fran, at the end of the month in Chicago, Boston, D.C., and New York. But Dean of Comedy on Twitter. Hope you follow me. Hope you come out to a show. It'll be fun. No pork, but we'll have Sharia law.
Okay, so you're for Vice President, and Reince Priebus for President of Vice. Dean, thank you so much. Have a great weekend.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Take care.
We'll be right back with more and your calls on The Stephanie Miller Show.
You can't turn her off. Not in the middle of turning her on. It's the Stephanie Miller Show.
Stephanie Miller Show. You're listening to Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers with a really cool blues song called High in the Morning from his last album, Mojo, which about 12 people bought, but it's one of the coolest Tom Petty albums. It's pretty much a straight-up blues record and some really groovy grooves. So not a mashup, a real song, and I love Tom Petty, and he needs to release a new record, so that's why we're playing that. And thank you so much for spending your morning here. Steph and the Mooks will be back on Monday, but for today, I am so thrilled to be joined by the great TV's Frank Conniff, and by comedian Trevon Free and Silent Tony on the mic. And your calls at 1-800-STEPH-12. I want to point out that the big documentary about Stephanie Miller's sexy liberal comedy tour airs tonight on Current TV. The premiere drops at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We'll air again at 3 a.m. That's midnight for you West
Coast
people.
That's when I'll be watching it.
Yeah, that's right. That's when you get home and kick the groupies out. So please, please check it out. I can't recommend it highly enough. It'll give you a small taste of what it's like to be on the tour that conservatives don't want you to see. The tour, we started off in Madison, Wisconsin, in April of 2011 to raise some money for Wisconsin United. And it wound up grossing over $1 million the first year. Our album became the first political comedy record to go to number one on the Amazon and iTunes and Billboard charts, all with no label support, totally independent. We had 4 Pollstar nominations, and it's really just, you know, a few of us putting it together. But it really speaks to the power of Stephanie as a broadcaster and her fan base that, you know, this radio show was such a great platform for a comedy tour. And you know, you always hear how people love Jon Stewart and Bill Maher, but, you know, you don't get political comedy in clubs.
Right.
So we thought, let's put together a show that brings a really entertaining and inspiring show to people. And to our astonishment, people were ready for something like that. And it's been a real
ride.
When do we get volume 2?
You'll have to ask Miss Miller. I'm working on that, trying to get see if Aisha wants to be a part of that, too.
It's going to be like Led Zeppelin, Sexy Liberal Comedy Tour 2. Three,
yes,
four.
We'll call it IV. We'll call it Zofo for the. although I want to say we are playing in Seattle, Washington on the 29th of September. That's a Saturday at the Paramount Theater, which is a huge, beautiful place the Marx Brothers have played at. And then we're going to be at New York's historic Beacon Theater on the 27th of October. I'm thrilled about that.
That's a big deal.
The Beacon, man. It's like, who hasn't played there? Rolling Stones played there. I saw Bob Dylan and Patti Smith together at the Beacon. It's just so much history.
If you guys are going to be there, where's there going to be time for the Allman Brothers to play? They do a month there every
they
year.
Do a they do a week. They do a week there.
Oh, just a week.
They book it solid for a whole week, and I think that's in September actually. And I'm thrilled because I also just moved. I've only lived in Greenwich Village my whole life, and I just moved to the Upper West Side so I can walk to the show. And Upper West Side's a great place if you like watching white women shopping.
this is a plug for Zabar's.
Magnolia Bakery. Let's take some calls from some of these mooks, shall we, gentlemen? Denise in North Carolina, good morning. You're on the Stephanie Miller Show with Frank Conniff and Trevon Free.
Good morning. Hi, Trevon. I'm so glad you're back.
Oh, wow. Thank you very much.
You did a Jesus move, didn't you?
I did.
No, 3 days later.
Too bad he's never going to do it.
Oh, that's a shame.
Well, how are you? How are you, Denise? Would you have a comment about Governor Romney, right?
I do. I have a comment, and it's about the statement that Mittens put out.
Mm-hmm.
And it was basically about the standards and, you know, what we believe in this country. This country was built on freedom of religion. And he forgot his own roots. That's why his grandfather or great-grandfather came to this country.
Mm.
I say that to say this. Was it an apology? No, it is not an apology. If I was in that embassy, I would have wrote that and a whole lot more about this no-name guy who wrote this film.
I agree.
I feel that the president should come back on this and make a statement about what we truly believe in this country because we're losing sight of it.
Yeah. Well, and again, you can respect First Amendment rights while also acknowledging that free speech has consequences.
Right.
Yes, it does. And I really believe that his consequences should be to be rearrested on some type of violations and put in a prison with the Nation of Islam.
Mm-hmm. I
agree.
For
a little religious education.
Well, that would be nice to see, and I do thank you for the call. You know, again, this was a great example for Mitt Romney to act like a leader. And I think if he just said, you know, I joined the president in condemning all violence, we mourn the loss of our diplomats, he would have seemed really presidential.
That if he becomes president and there's a crisis, he will act very swiftly to not know what the hell he's doing. He'll not know what the hell he's doing right off the bat without any hesitation.
And I should let our Republican trolls know that I know you guys don't respect Obama, but I have it on very good authority from people I know in the White House that in the event of a crisis, the Secret Service is authorized to give President Obama a copy of My Pet Goat. Okay? That's true. So you
don't need to worry.
Okay, so we got to go to break, right, Tony? The time has come. We're going to be going to, but we will be taking your calls when we come back. Couple of quick announcements. I'm going to be performing with Hal Sparks, a very special pre-election show at the Barrymore Theater in Madison, Wisconsin on October 6th, and doing Laughing Liberally off Broadway all through next month, every Monday night. And then a very special show I'm thrilled about on September 19th, that's next week, the Penn American Center presents Stand Up for Freedom. That's a show in the Dumbo section of Brooklyn with myself and Baratunde Thurston, hilarious comedian and writer for The Onion, and a really great performer in his own right. Also with Nagin Farsad, a hilarious female Muslim comic, and Katie Halper. That's going to be on the 19th, and I'll put that on my Facebook page, too. I'm not funny, folks. I steal everything from Carlos Mencia, so God knows who really wrote it. But come see Baratunde Thurston at that show. We'll be taking your calls when we come back. It's a great time to be alive, because we get to be alive the same time as the Stephanie Miller Show.
Gentlemen, it's the Stephanie Miller Show.
The Stephanie Miller Show. I'm John Fugelsang. Good morning, and thank you for joining us. Joined by Trevon Free and Frank Conniff here. We had a little bit of a technical glitch, and we missed our throw to Jackie Schechter in the Current News Bureau, but I know all y'all got it over there. So she's at least still letting us know what's going on. And we're taking your calls at 1-800-STEPH-12. You know, I want to point out one of the strangest things that happened the week of the GOP convention that made virtually no headlines. We know that the GOP put in their platform that they wanted no abortion, no access to abortion for women, even in cases of rape or incest. Mm-hmm. But that same week, Governor Romney came out and for the first time bucked the base of his party and said he supported abortion rights for victims of rape. Now, this is never a pleasant subject to talk about, but I found it kind of strange because Governor Romney says he supports abortion rights for rape victims, but he also plans to completely repeal Roe versus Wade. And he said this to David Gregory over the weekend when David Gregory was giving him the pedicure on Meet the Press. So I don't really understand how you can support completely repealing Roe versus Wade, but still support access to abortion rights for rape victims. But Governor Romney's doing it. And that's the triple axel double flip-flop in the same week. And for some reason, he avoided getting a lot of heat from the mainstream media for it and avoided getting any heat from the Tea Party base. From the GOP base. The Tea Party is not all anti-abortion.
Mm-hmm. But how does the president repeal a Supreme Court judgment?
Well, what he said was that he'll appoint Supreme Court judges who will help advance that cause. Because, as we know, liberals who are disaffected with President Obama, you still have to vote for President Obama because Ruth Bader Ginsburg is 131 years old. We have a caller, a very special caller, with a story that somewhat pertains to this. Good morning, Amanda. You're on the Stephanie Miller Show. Are you there?
Good morning. Hello. How are you all?
Very good, thank you. How are you?
I'm just fine. Thank you.
So
I really appreciate you taking my call.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Well, it sounded really interesting. Please, we don't have a lot of time, but please tell us your background.
Well, I wanted to share the story because it's incredibly important what could happen if women don't vote for this election. My story is I lost my mom very young. I was only 21. She was very loving, but she definitely had a dark side. And I was lucky enough to be very close with her best friend. And one night I was really struggling with why my mom had been so unhappy. And she sat me down and said, listen, I'm going to tell you something, and you have to keep this to yourself. You can never share this with anybody in the family, but I know that you need to know this. When your mom was a teenager, she had been raped, and it was by more than one perpetrator, and she got pregnant. Being that it was the 50s, my mother had a back alley abortion.
Oh, my God.
And she was told that she would never have children, and then she probably went ahead and had four.
Yeah, that's good. I'm very glad to hear that.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm incredibly close with my brothers. I'm very, very lucky to have them in my life. But this story that this dear friend told me, I needed to hear because I needed to understand why my mother was so unhappy. And while it broke my heart, at the same time, it explained so much. So for me, to hear Todd Akin say that there's legitimate and illegitimate rape,
right,
absolutely enraged me. It literally sent me over the moon, especially knowing that this is something that my mother had been through. And it's not something I can talk to anybody about, my family members. There's no reason for my brothers to know this.
Of course.
They had a very different relationship with her than I did. And to have learned this after she passed away was also obviously very devastating, but at the same time, like I said, it explained so much.
Mm.
So it's incredibly important for people to be in really aware of this war on women. It's just, mm-hmm. This is 2012. I mean, how could we possibly be going back and for, I hate to say it, but for men to be making these decisions, and it's not a decision, it's not a choice, it's something horrific to go through,
right,
to even have to contemplate it. It's not some thing you come upon and say, oh, well, yeah, you know, I might just do that.
Of course, of course.
It's not easy.
And it's something no one takes lightly as well.
I'm really glad that you're sharing this story, just for the simple fact that I think more people need to hear stuff like this, because with people like Todd Akin, I think the divide is they don't realize that real people go through these things.
Right.
These mm-hmm. things happen to real women, mm-hmm. real people in people's families, mothers, mm-hmm. daughters, sisters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they go on TV and they parrot these talking points and they say things about women who, and it makes you think, are there even women in your life? Like, do you know any women?
And plus the idea that going back to like the caller mentioned, the 50s, like going back to the way it was where people had to be secretive and it
right.
was shameful and
right.
you had to get an illegal abortion and it wasn't safe, and the idea of returning to all that's
right.
going to make America better somehow is
right.
just outrageous.
Yeah.
It really is. And I mean, to be honest with you, I really feel like this was something that she had to endure and suffer with in silence her entire life. I mean, my mom was a big smoker. I mean, you know, I remember
smoker of cigarettes?
Yes, a smoker, yeah, a big smoker of cigarettes, and she drank terrible wine, jug wine. Had she drunk better wine, perhaps she'd still be alive.
Do you think that she struggled with shame over all this entire horror? I mean, was it something that caused her shame, or was she able to overcome it emotionally?
Never. She never, ever overcame it.
Well, that's another thing, is if something like that, if you were raped, you know, is there was this shame, and you weren't even allowed back then or it was a taboo to even go out and talk about it,
yeah.
and to get help for it. And I get the impression that these Republicans want to go back to that too. That if
right.
you were
Absolutely.
If you were raped, oh well, was it a legitimate rape? Was
yes,
it a forcible
exactly.
rape?
I mean, the idea right. of a legitimate
they're trying
rape
to go,
is insane.
Yeah, they're trying to go back to all that shaming, and it's yeah.
And you know what? I want to point something out as well. There was a Gallup poll last May. We talked about this briefly earlier in the week. That showed that 20% of Americans favor a complete ban on abortion in all cases. 25% of Americans support abortion being legal and accessible in all cases. Only 43% of Americans in this Gallup poll identified as pro-choice. And a lot of folks on the right said this is proof that abortion support is declining in America. Now, I have never in my life met anyone who was pro-abortion. Okay, right. There are no pro-abortion people in the world. There are people who are pro-women's reproductive health rights, people who are pro-allowing women to have access to abortion, people who are pro-letting women make that decision because it's between them and their doctors and God.
Right.
They don't want to interfere. And there are many conservatives who feel that it's not the state's place to get in the way of a woman and
her doctor. I would think, too, that things like Planned Parenthood and birth control and all that stuff has brought down the number of abortions. Right.
Exactly.
In our country.
And they went down under Bill Clinton every year. But here's the interesting thing about this 43%. 25% of people in this Gallup poll said that they supported abortion in all cases. 52% of Americans, 52% in the same poll, said that they support abortion in some cases, some or all cases, okay? 25% in all cases, 52% some or all cases. What this means is that 77% of Americans, according to this Gallup poll that was widely quoted by anti-abortion activists, 77% of all Americans endorse abortion rights in all or some cases. Only 43% call themselves pro-choice. Now, my parents did not like abortion. They were both ex-clergy. They felt abortion was used too casually as a method of retroactive birth control, but they supported women having the right to it. They didn't like it, but they voted Democratic because they thought women had a right. My mother was a nurse, and she had seen very horribly what could happen when people took this action into their own hands. And that's what being pro-choice is all about. You don't have to call yourself pro-choice. I'd love to ban pro-choice and pro-life because I think they're both manipulative terms. But it shows overall that if 77% of Americans support this, then that's the reality we're dealing with. And Mitt Romney and the GOP are playing to a very narrow part of their base. And we know there's plenty of Republicans, even anti-abortion Republicans, who have supported this in the past, too. And I thank you so much, Amanda, for the bravery of your call. It really says to me that we don't have an abortion problem in this country. We have an unwanted pregnancy problem. Abortion is the symptom. When we can get all the Todd Akins and Mitt Romneys and Barack Obamas and Cardinal Dolans together, we can get the right and the left together and say, what are we going to do about unwanted pregnancy? And what are we going to do to make this society safer for women to avoid being raped? Then you'll see the abortion symptom decline. As Bill Clinton said, I'd love to see it be safe, legal, and rare.
Yeah, and I think that the most important thing is education. If we just educate women and men and at a very young age and instruct them in how to take care of their bodies and be aware of everything, that is the first front. And then, obviously, you know, hopefully that won't have to be the case.
Right, absolutely. I think we need to also stop pretending that sex is this really taboo subject, which would increase teaching younger kids how to be protected and how to do things properly and to avoid unwanted pregnancy in the first place.
Exactly.
It's not a taboo subject in my house. It's a taboo practice. It doesn't matter.
Well, Amanda, I want to thank you for the call. It was very brave of you. And
gentlemen, thank you so very much for listening and for what you've done for me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Have a great weekend. I really do thank you for that call. Wow. Okay, well, there's for the comedy show, but I'm glad she called because I know plenty
of
conservatives who are offended by
that.
What Todd Akin said as well. Mm-hmm. And again, when they talk about war on women, it may seem like hyperbole, but this is the reality women are dealing with, and it's easy for men to talk about. It's quite a different thing to be a woman and live in this society. Mm-hmm. We do want to know what you think, so please call us at 1-800-STEPH-12, and we will be right back with the Stephanie Miller Show.
It's like a Mensa meeting with fart jokes. It's the Stephanie Miller Show.
This is the Stephanie Miller Show, and you're listening to Paul McCartney and Wings, with one of two Paul McCartney songs that was banned by the BBC in the 70s. The other was High, High, High. Wings was pretty edgy, people forget. And this is a song McCartney released called Give Ireland Back to the Irish, which was very critical of...
And did he do the song Give Conniff Back to Ireland?
No, that was the cast of Mystery Science Theater that did that song. Trace Ballou and Joel Hodgson sang that. But that's one of two McCartney songs that were banned. And Paul McCartney has a new album out with Diana Krall and her band. That's an album of jazz standards. It's called Kisses on the Bottom, which is a terrible title. It comes from a line in the song, I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter. But it's Paul McCartney, and it's the first album he's ever done where he plays no instruments. And he just sings, and he sings mostly old standards with two new songs, which are two of the best things he's written in
and
years.
And is it duets with Diana?
No, I wish it was. She doesn't sing. She plays piano.
Great sounding album. I'd love to hear it.
Well, we'll have to play a cut later in the show.
His songwriting has always been very influenced by old standards.
You know, and this album of his features songs by, it's got songs, everything from like Always to More I Cannot Wish You, Bye Bye Blackbird, songs he loved as a kid, songs that some people say the Beatles are responsible for killing, you know, that whole genre of songs. And
the Beatles always had that kind of, in addition to all the rock, they had that kind of Tin Pan Alley influence in their songs from the beginning.
The Beatles used to cover songs from The Music Man live on stage.
Till There Was You.
Yeah. So McCartney's a guy who still does, really edgy stuff when he's not trying to, and that was a song that was banned for being too sympathetic to Ireland.
I was born in 1985.
You were?
Yeah.
Oh, that's appalling. You were born in 1985?
Yeah.
You were born when Ferris Bueller came out.
That was 1985 is the year I sobered up, so in a way that was my first year in consciousness.
Wow, okay, when Ferris Bueller came out, Trevon Free was one. mercy. Okay, Cynthia in Kansas City, you've been on hold for quite a while. Welcome to the Stephanie Miller Show. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you.
If we've ever needed proof that Governor Romney is incompetent to run this country, it is this past week in his whole take on diplomacy and foreign relations. He does not have a clue that the letter that was sent out is something. The words may be different, you know, the word from the top may be different, but the fact that they sent out a letter is what diplomacy is all about.
You mean the statement released unauthorized by the embassy staffer in Egypt?
Exactly.
Yes.
This is what they do every day around the world, every embassy, every consulate, every mission. People are there doing their diplomacy.
Cynthia, do you think that Governor Romney's campaign was just feeling so desperate because of the poll numbers? Another one has the president up by 7 points that they just, as the president said, shot before they aimed and had some overreach, and they jumped the gun a bit too soon on this.
I think without a doubt, but he's also showing that he is ignorant of the facts. And I know the facts of diplomacy because, very simply, I have lived it. My father was the 11th black man permitted to join the U.S. Foreign Service in 1945.
Wow.
And for 35 years, he represented this country.
Wow. As a government employee.
That's how they represented it.
Right on. Well, I couldn't agree with you more, and I thank you for your point of view and your wisdom on that. The governor really stepped in it, and, you know, if you don't believe me, listen to some of the conservatives.
I think the one silver lining for Romney is that he was so incompetent this week that it makes everyone forget all the incompetence of every other week. Every week he does something. Because before this, you know, it was the David Gregory thing where he said he supported parts of Obama.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now everybody's forgotten
Actually, that's
that.
Right. All the conservatives who were really mad when he said he supported parts of Obamacare forgotten that because of the latest outrage.
It's so, who knows what next week will
and
bring.
And I tell all our conservative listeners, I read your hate tweets. I know y'all hate, but let me tell you, this is Citizens United. It hurt you. You guys could have had a real conservative running for your nomination, and instead you have Mitt Romney buying the nomination.
They want some Monopoly guy.
Philip is calling us from Atlanta. Good morning, Philip. You're on the Stephanie Miller Show.
Good morning, guys. How are you?
Great. How are you?
Good, good. Now, I got to say, my girlfriend, Grogley, walked into the room one morning here and looked at the TV set as you were filling in for Bill Press, and she said, "Hello, who is this handsome devil?" And I was like, he and Bill are both good, have come from good Catholic backgrounds and are also progressive. And, of course, she Googled you and, you know.
I have an extremely Catholic background. Well, that's very kind. I actually am going to be guest hosting Bill's show in D.C. on Monday morning. So I'm going to have time to go home and see. Right on. And Bill, of course, I do want to stress Bill Press is a very fine journalist. I am the opposite. I have no journalistic credibility. I am a professional clown. Send me your hate and scornful tweets. But I'm a big fan of Bill Press. And the best thing about doing Stephanie's show is it guarantees that I'm up early in the morning driving, listening to Bill Press as I try to not run into deer on Mulholland Drive. It's dark.
They're our biggest listeners, the deer, at that early morning.
Well, Philip, I thank you for the call, and I thank your girlfriend for her incredibly poor eyesight. What do you want to talk about?
Well, what I really want to mention is the Occupy movement. We're both supporters of the Occupy movement and the Obama administration. And I realize great, brilliant people, thoughtful people like Tom Morello, who's kind of been at the forefront.
Of course, from Rage Against the Machine, the musician from Rage Against the Machine.
Right, exactly. And now the Night Watchman basically says, well, the only thing I have in common with them is the fact that we both have, you know, fathers that are from Kenya and white mothers. with my girlfriend, I think he fails to acknowledge they probably have much more in common than he realizes. And the fact that my girlfriend's father was arrested in the Civil Rights Movement, sat in the same jail cell with Big Gregory.
Wow.
My aunt was a delegate at the convention, at the Democratic convention. You know, there are two questions I really want to pose for the Occupy movement.
Make it quick, okay? Really quick.
Number one, why not get a 99% party to get more people like a Bernie Sanders representing there in Congress? Second, you're not going to have real impact and change, I don't see, until we do see those same sit-ins and boycotts you had back in the Civil Rights Movement, the paralyzed business as usual.
You're right. And well, I think you're right, and I thank you for the call, Philip. I'm sorry we're so pressed for time. I want to become famous enough that I can sponsor my own million non-millionaire march. Because I think that's, if someone could do that, I'll help with it. The million non-millionaire march to go and demand fair taxation.
Did you hear the dismissive remark Chris Christie made about the Occupy movement?
What did he say, Frank?
Let me eat cake.
I didn't hear that.
I mean,
really, that's what he said?
Yeah.
Here's the thing with Occupy, and we got to go to break, but I love Occupy. I had the pleasure on the tour last year to visit over a dozen of them. There's three points they should make to get their credibility back, and I want to lay out what I think those three points are, and we'll be explaining that when we come back after the break. We've still got some very special guests. We have two congressmen left on this show. So we have plenty coming up. And Katrina Vandenhuvel from The Nation will be calling in as well. This is The Stephanie Miller Show. I'm John Fugelsang. Delighted to have you here. And we'll be right back after these messages. This is the Stephanie Miller Show. I'm John Fugelsang, filling in for Steph this Friday. It's been a great week. You're listening to Heads Will Roll by the Yeah Yeah Yeahs and Karen O. Great rock and roll album, and really one of the best bands in America right now. We thank you so much for joining us this morning, and I'm very, very pleased to welcome our next guest, because Congressman John Yarmuth, in addition to being a friend of Stephanie's show, is the U.S. Representative for Kentucky's 3rd Congressional District, serving since 2007. Congressman Yarmuth, welcome to the Stephanie Miller Show.
Thanks, John. Good to be with you.
It's a thrill. And before we begin the actual interview part of the interview, I want to congratulate you because about 6 weeks ago, Corporate Voices for Working Families and Working Mother Media named you, Congressman John Yarmuth of Kentucky, a recipient of the 2012 Best of Congress Award, which celebrates lawmakers for their leadership in improving the quality of life for working families.
Well, I appreciate that. I was honored to receive that recognition, and those are issues that I care deeply about, and one reason I'm a Democrat. But
well, I watch a lot of Fox News, Congressman, because I'm a thinker, and when I hear that that you support working families and quality of life, that tells me that you're a class warfare wager who hates the job creators.
Yes, well, that too.
I've been conditioned to believe that. Do you find it interesting, sir, that the class warfare language about class warfare has become so focused anytime someone in Congress wants to actually help working families?
I know. It's pretty bizarre. I say you're right. There has been there has been class warfare in this country, and the wealthy class has won. I mean,
yeah.
that war is over.
Mm-hmm.
We got to find another one now for everybody else.
It seems they only talk about the class warfare from the bottom up and not from the top.
Yes.
Down.
Exactly. If you fight for the 99%, it's class warfare. If you fight for the top 1%, it's pro-growth.
I was amused. They came out with statistics not too long ago that for, in a two-year period, 93% of all the new income in the country went to the top 1%.
Exactly.
And I said, after that, the Republican reaction was, how did we let that 7% get away?
Yeah.
So they proposed even larger tax cuts for the 1%.
Well, and it's all the more reason why, you know, so many people who are paying attention to things like facts and numbers are terrified of the budget, which features no facts and numbers, of your colleague Paul Ryan, sir.
That's right, and I do serve on the Budget Committee and have been fighting that one for this entire Congress. But know, I think he is being hoisted on his own petard, as it were, right now, because Democratic candidates throughout the country are describing to their voters exactly what's in that, and that's not voting well for Democrats who voted for it, and for Republicans who voted for it, virtually everyone did.
Everyone did, indeed, and now they have to double down on, you know, turning Medicare into a voucher scheme. And I was wondering, do you find it encouraging that now that Paul Ryan is not really in the GOP bubble, but he's actually out there speaking to people who don't live in that bubble, that the American people are starting to wake up about some of the problems in his budget?
Well, exactly right. And basically what he does is again, provide even deeper tax cuts for the wealthiest Americans, and pays for that by reducing programs that help working families and lower income Americans. And what I call the human infrastructure part of the economy. I mean, taking money away from education and in Pell Grants and nutrition programs, and even things like food inspection and FAA protect air traffic controllers. I mean, these are the programs that actually are getting whacked while they lower taxes for millionaires.
He's pro-ptomaine poisoning growth.
Congressman, it seems like that's the opposite of what conservatism is, and it really seems like it's the opposite of what patriotism is to me. And when we had Rick Unger of Forbes.com on earlier in the week, who talked about how this president has overseen the slowest growth in government spending since Dwight Eisenhower. When you look at that and the fact that he wants to, you know, have taxes go back up 3% on the top income earners, which was planned by the Bush administration to go back into effect in 2010, it's Bush's tax increase. It seems to me that on so many measures, when you look at what the word conservative really means, much like Bill Clinton before him, Barack Obama really is the responsible fiscal conservative in the room.
You know, you've brought up something that I've made a point of whenever I can, that spending has not increased dramatically under the Obama administration. People think it has. Again, that's that Fox News bubble that so many people live in. And the problem is on the revenue side. I mean, basically, we just haven't seen increases in revenue that keep up. And so you're right. President Obama, and I mean, the size of government's down, the number of employees are down. It's just remarkable, the disconnect of reality from so many people on the other side.
And when we didn't have a Democratic president, Paul Ryan voted for every deficit increase.
Indeed, he did. 6.8 increase in the deficit.
He did more to increase the deficit than any of us will ever do.
He's like that guy. He's like that guy that goes out to dinner with a bunch of rich guys and orders everything because he knows he's not paying the tab.
You're exactly right. You know, in fact, you make a good point, Trevon, because Congressman, I've said for a long time that, you know, George W. Bush, when we would have more funding for the wars, it was never built into the budget. It was always supplemental income he'd go asking for from Congress. So really, on an economic level, George Bush is guilty of the greatest dine and dash and restaurant or government history. Is that a fair critique? Is it a fair critique, sir?
Absolutely. There's no question about it. I mean, during the Bush administration, two wars off the books, a huge prescription drug benefit that was not paid for, and then these two major tax cuts that, again, put us in this deficit position. I mean, I think the number was something like $1.1 trillion or $1.2 trillion that was built into the deficit when President Obama took office. That's what he inherited. Now, it's stayed that way primarily because income to the government hasn't risen. That obviously the country's in a difficult economic time. The recovery hasn't been strong, so revenues haven't increased. But that deficit, most of it, was built into the system by the Bush administration.
Exactly right. We don't have a deficit problem. We have a revenue problem. And it seems like to me Mitt Romney is proof that in some ways maybe the aristocracy of the 1% is like the mob, and America's the restaurant they're burning down for the insurance money. I mean, you hear about this stereotype of tax and spend Democrats, but the borrow and spend Republicans got us into this mess. And it seems more and more that the Republican Party, as it now stands, really embodies all the traits of the worst stereotypes of Democrats.
Yes, I don't think there's any question about it. And, you know, Bill Clinton did, I guess, what probably was the greatest contrast to that. I mean, he did raise taxes. He did get a handle on government spending. And he showed that when you do that, you can get economic growth, you can create jobs, and reduce the deficit.
As Eisenhower and Reagan proved before him.
Exactly right.
So what can ordinary citizens do who are waking up out of the matrix and who realize that we're being fed all this GOP propaganda beyond just voting? How can regular Americans get more civically involved to help educate our conservative brothers and sisters that the Republican Party is all talk and no responsibility?
Well, you know one thing I do. I come from a media background, and
you were a radio show host.
I published the alternative weekly newspaper in Louisville for.
I would love to have a media
years.
Background, by the way.
Well, you're getting one, I guess. What seems to me has been happening, and we talk about the Fox News bubble, is that we really have had a dysfunctional, along with a dysfunctional Congress and government, we've had a dysfunctional media over the last 10, 15 years anyway, and the vast majority of people are not getting a truly balanced perspective on what's going on, and the media have lost track, and I'm talking primarily about TV right now.
Right.
That basically their idea of balance is put somebody on from either side and let them scream at each other and never being willing to take a position and say they're right, they're wrong, here are the facts.
Make a false equivalency between the two all the time.
Right. And one of the way I phrase it is that unfortunately in today's world, credibility has no market value. And the public has to make sure that credibility is valued. And I think that's going to happen because I have so many constituents that say to me, I just don't know who to believe anymore. Well, I can't believe anything I see on television. I can't believe anything I read in the newspaper. So we've got to make sure the public rewards credibility.
Does it seem, sir, like that's because there's no longer a central news authority, and as the media grows larger and news information becomes more niche, that everyone just gets the news that speaks to their biases, and there's no authoritative Walter Cronkite coming out and giving us the hard numbers that we all have to agree on?
Clearly, that's the problem. And, you know, the show Newsroom, which they premiered this year on the HBO show, was kind of based on that premise that some organization said, we're going to be the credible organization, and we'll see if we can survive that way.
Yeah, I think Aaron Sorkin did a great thing with that show. And even though people criticize it kind of heavily, I think it's having a Republican or a guy playing a Republican who actually wants to clean up the way news is done kind of like speaks to that whole notion.
That's why I thought it should have been on the Sci-Fi Channel.
Well, yeah. Congressman, it's quite fascinating because, as we pointed out on this show many times, Bill Clinton did balance the budget by working with conservatives. The last Republican president to balance a budget was Nixon, and some give LBJ credit for that, and the last Republican president to have a surplus was Eisenhower. So given all this, given the fact that Reagan never balanced a budget once, that the Republicans controlled under George W. Bush the White House, the House, and the Senate for 6 years and still couldn't balance a budget and left these deficits forever that the president's paying for now, why do you think conservatives still trust Republicans with their money?
Well, you know, when I talk to conservatives at home these days and kind of the business-type Republicans, I think they're getting very, very frustrated with their own party. I hear that more and more, that, you know, our party's just gone off the edge and or over the edge. And so I think people are waking up. I think you're seeing it now in some polling. I think the Republican convention, particularly Paul Ryan's performance and when he was taken to task for the lies that he told during that presentation, I think people are waking up to the fact that they're not getting honest perspectives from Republicans. So I'm very hopeful that this election will reflect that. I think the polling has started to reflect that. But even to the extent that white men are now coming back to Democrats more.
And Paul Ryan asked for Obamacare money and stimulus money.
Yeah, indeed,
indeed he did. I'm actually, sir, I got a job adapting Paul Ryan's speech into nonfiction form. I was impressed, by the way, to hear you use the word lies with Paul Ryan. Is that something you're comfortable doing?
Oh, absolutely. Because they know. I mean, you know, there's such a thing as mischaracterization, and sometimes people don't know, and they're spinning. But some of this stuff is just outright.
Well, Paul
lying.
Ryan,
I'm used to it because I live in a state with Mitch McConnell.
Do you have a good relationship with Mitch McConnell?
You know, I've known Mitch for 44 years.
Wow.
Mitch and I used to be political allies. I was Republican until 1985, and So I know
when Trayvon was born.
I know Mitch very well, and we have a good relationship. I think we have a civil relationship, but and I've been aggressive recently in taking him to task because I said to him in a letter, I said, "You're lying to my constituents."
Wow.
They also happen to be your constituents, but when people lie to my constituents, I'm going to make sure that my constituents have accurate information about issues that affect their lives.
Well, God bless you, sir.
I've said he's lying on national television. And I'm getting used to it. You run out of euphemisms after a while.
How dare you be biased against fact-challenged Americans,
right.
Sir? I got to thank you so much for your bluntness and your guts and for doing the Lord's work, and thank you for all you continue to do for working families. Congressman John Yarmuth of the great state of Kentucky, thank you so much, sir.
All right, John. Thanks for letting me talk with you.
What a pleasure. Have a great weekend.
You too.
What a man, what a mighty, mighty good man. We'll be right back and taking more of your calls on The Stephanie Miller Show.
Yeah, that woman's about as subtle as a rhinoceros horn up the backside.
It's The Stephanie Miller Show.
Show. That's the Yeah Yeah Yeahs again. I'm slacking on the mashups today. There's just too much good rock and roll to play. You are listening to the Stephanie Miller Show or watching us on Current TV. I want to reiterate a very important announcement. Current TV has produced an excellent documentary about Stephanie Miller's sexy liberal comedy tour, the comedy tour that broke records of all kinds on stage and on albums and comedy charts, and it's premiering tonight on Current TV. Set your DVRs. They still have TiVos, Frank? Is TiVo still around?
In my house, probably.
You still have Beta in your house, right?
I have the Sexy Liberal Comedy Tour on Laserdisc.
You have the 8-track, actually, the only 8-track issue for that. That's going to be tonight at 9 p.m. It features Hal Sparks, the brilliant Aisha Tyler, Stephanie Miller. I think I appear on it, and it's going to be a lot of fun. It was filmed at three different shows on the tour. Had a really cool documentary about the first ever progressive political comedy tour on this kind of scale. So check it out. I recommend it highly. We have Catherine in California, and Catherine, you've been on hold for over an hour, and so I really want to hear your thoughts on Mitt Romney, because obviously you mean it. Good morning.
Yes, I just wanted to say that for Mitt Romney and Reince Priebus talking about to take the statement in that was made by the embassy and say that that is sympathizing with the terrorist is like saying that a hostage negotiator is sympathizing with the criminal.
That's a great point.
By asking, for his demands. They're trying to save lives, and you do whatever you can at that moment to try to save lives, to try to explain that with free speech and freedom of religion, we also practice religious tolerance, and that's what we promote along with it. So, when these idiots, like Cynthia was saying, diplomacy is more than, a talking point for Republicans, and that's all I want to say.
Well, thank you, Catherine. I think you're completely right, and I think it's a sign that, I think Mitt Romney believes in diplomacy. I just think the problem is he believes in listening to what his horrible advisors tell him even more.
And a lot of his advisors are the same people that advised Bush. He's taking the people who were behind the worst foreign policy blunder in our nation's history, and they're his advisors.
Yeah, and part of it also, I have to give credit to his communications director, the man in charge of all the messaging, Eric Fernstrom, my old buddy. Of course, Mr. Fernstrom was the one with the now very well-known Etch-a-Sketch comment. He was the guy who came out on July 3rd or July 2nd of this summer and called and said that Obamacare under the Affordable Care Act was a penalty, not a tax. The next day, the Wall Street Journal had a scathing editorial about Mitt Romney and his advisors.
The liberal Wall Street Journal.
Yes, that ultra-liberal. And the next day, Mitt Romney came out and said, no, it's not a penalty. It is a tax. It's a penalty when I do it. It's a tax when Obama does it. Rupert Murdoch himself tweeted that weekend, the first weekend in July, that Mitt Romney needed to dump his advisors. He hasn't done it yet. I admire his loyalty because Mitt Romney's loyalty is helping get the president reelected.
Yes. He's doing more to get Obama reelected than any of us are. So we should thank him for that.
The more his campaign goes on, I start to think that, they're working for Obama. Like there's some insiders in there.
Well, during the debates, I mean, last year when we had, you know, you had Herman Cain and Michelle Bachmann and Rick Perry. I called them Obama's reelection committee. It looks like every week they're meeting to just see how much they can want disaffected young people to vote for President Obama.
They're trying so hard, but like 49% of the country just won't latch onto it.
It's like that bubble you talk about. They really think that their narrow view of the world is the way everybody.
Right.
And they're actually out of the mainstream.
Well, it's interesting because this leads us back to this Paul Ryan thing that we've talked about fleetingly over the past couple of days, where Paul Ryan had made a statement on KRDO TV in Colorado last Friday about medical marijuana. And Congressman Ryan said, "My personal positions on this issue have been let the states decide what to do with these things." Now, that is the Ron Paul point of view. That is the conservative point of view. Let the states decide. It's the conservative argument for marriage equality as well. Well, Paul Ryan said this, and right away, Mitt Romney's people were doing damage control, and now saying that Paul Ryan
agrees with Mitt.
No, they said that he completely agrees with Mitt Romney on keeping marijuana illegal, despite what he said last week, and that people who smoke marijuana, even if they're sick and have cancer, deserve to be in jail.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, so they doubled down on it. And we played a clip yesterday that I'm going to play in the next hour of the show. It was from the 2007 campaign when Governor Romney was running against Senator McCain for the nomination, where a very sick man, it's a famous clip on YouTube, a fellow who was had cancer in a wheelchair, met Governor Romney at a campaign event and asked him what he should do because the synthetic marijuana made him sick and vomit. Governor Romney's response was both so callous and cowardly at the same time that we're going to play, it's a one-minute clip, we're going to play it again in the next hour to watch these guys doubling down. Because I do think that marijuana should not just be legal, maybe it should be forcibly administered to Congress. Maybe then they just get along and pass some laws to help working people. I don't really know. I'm not into that whole culture. Those horrible potheads like Willie Nelson who hate freedom. So we're going to be taking your calls. Coming up in the next hour, we have Katrina Vandenhuvel of The Nation, which I'm very excited about. So we want to hear from you at 1-800-STEPH-12. We'll also be back with the Jackie Schechter current news update very soon. This is The Stephanie Miller Show. I've missed Mom as much as y'all have. Only one more hour stuck with us, and then you get her back next week, folks. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
Gentlemen, it's the Stephanie Miller Show.
Good morning. It's the Stephanie Miller Show, an action-packed Friday after an action-packed week. If you were expecting a slow news week, wow, Steph took the wrong week to go away. But it's been my great honor to be here for you all week. I'm John Fugelsang, filling in for Steph, and it's been really a great pleasure for all the great guests we've had. And that continues right now with our next guest. Why, who could it be? From the great state of Washington, it's Congressman Adam Smith. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. How are you?
Wonderful. What a pleasure to have you here.
Great to be on, as always.
Well, I'm honored because this was the week where Mitt Romney really showed that he is to foreign policy discourse what Pat Buchanan is to breakdancing at a Wu-Tang Clan concert.
Funny, I never thought of it quite that way, but I think that's probably apt.
That's why you're the legislator and I'm the clown doing comedy clubs. Ooh. But I'm very curious for your take on it, sir, because you have a rich foreign policy experience yourself from your time in the House. And I'm wondering, how has it been for you watching Governor Romney take these positions that aren't really grounded in fact this week?
You know, a couple big things. I mean, first of all, we've clearly seen the governor does not handle crisis situations very well. Sort of as, well, the president said it best, you know, ready, shoot, aim, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially there's no situation that he won't try to cravenly take political advantage of. And I could walk through all the details of everything he said and how wrong it was, but it was a well-documented display of someone who's not ready to be commander-in-chief. But that's actually not the part of it that frightens me the most. It's the underlying ideology behind what he's saying, which is basically if he becomes president, he thinks that his role on foreign policy is to try to impose the will of the United States on the rest of the world. Wherever there's a problem, we are going to force the rest of the world to do things exactly the way we want to.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen that before. I don't want to go to war in Syria or mm-hmm. Iran or any of a bunch of other places. I'm mindful of the fact that there are other places in the world that are going to do things that we don't like, that we can't necessarily just force them to change.
Congressman, stop apologizing for America.
You're exactly right, Congressman.
I think it is dangerous. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, this is part of the new American century. America has to dominate. The rest of the world has to bend to our will. That I think creates a less prosperous, more dangerous world for all of us, and especially for Americans.
I agree. I think a national humility helps our national dignity and profile. And we certainly saw this week because the Chinese media have become the latest to slam Romney. Reuters reports that the Chinese Xinhua news agency slammed Mitt Romney on Friday for calling China a currency manipulator in a piece that they also published in English just for Americans to read. They called Romney's words ironic since, quote, a considerable portion of this China battering politician's wealth was actually obtained by doing business with Chinese companies before he entered politics.
Burned.
He's now offended the Chinese, the Russians, the Libyans, Egyptians, Americans, and of course the British. The Belgians are still fine with him.
But none of that matters because I think Mitt Romney is showing us that his pick for Secretary of State is probably going to be Donald Trump. Because you remember Donald Trump saying, "Hey, look, we got a problem with China. I just go over there, I talk to him, problem fixed."
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Donald Trump. He used a certain 12-letter Oedipal obscenity that we can't say on the air in terms of how he would deal with China.
Exactly. And the thing is, I mean, as a comedian, you've got a field day in front of you, and I congratulate you on having Mitt Romney as a candidate. You know, but looking at the policy in the future here, we really have to. This is grounded in conservative ideology. This is not just Mitt Romney sort of stumbling around and not knowing what he's talking about on mm-hmm. foreign policy, though certainly that's part of it. It is grounded in this notion of belligerence as the best approach to making your way in the world. And it is very dangerous.
Congressman, do you think that's because that really is at the core root of their beliefs, that sort of petulance and that sort of you must bend to our will? Or is that just how they're playing to an increasingly fractured and marginalized base? The tougher they talk, the more the Republican voting base might be inspired to go out and vote on Election Day.
Well, I think that's certainly what's motivated Mitt Romney, because he doesn't have much in the way of foreign policy or national security experience. Obviously, given that he was governor of Massachusetts and that whole well-documented thing where he wasn't always a right-wing conservative, he had to take extreme steps to sort of solidify the base and make them think that he was one of them. So I think he's adopting that philosophy. He's doing it because he thinks it appeals to the base. But I think it's, you know, based on my experience back here, it's a little more deep-rooted than that. And I don't have a problem with the notion that America should lead in the world. Certainly we should. But leadership, regrettably, is not a matter of simply snapping your fingers and have everybody around you jump. It's a matter of figuring out how to work with other people to get them to move in the direction that you want them to move. And that's a skill that I think the right-wing conservatives simply do not possess.
Indeed, sir. Let me ask you, how do you feel when you hear the expression American exceptionalism? Does that sound like a form of national pride, or does it sound like an arrogance to you?
Well, I mean, it depends on the context. National pride, I think, for the most part, then I think there is something special about America.
I do, too.
You know, we're a country in the world where for the last 200-plus years, people have wanted to come here to build a better life for themselves. We have a capacity for change, an entrepreneurial spirit. You know, but if you're using it in the context of talking to our neighbors, saying, before we get started here, I just want to establish that we're better than you, as long as you understand that, we're going to get along just fine, that doesn't work. I think, you know, many countries in the world are exceptional in different ways, and you've got to respect that.
And
be confident in who you are, but don't denigrate everybody else.
Shouldn't exceptionalism be just trying to behave in an exceptional manner as opposed to it being your your policy that
yeah.
your policy being we're better than everybody as
and the rules don't
to
apply
just,
to us
because part of American exceptionalism to use that term would be that we're the compassionate, humane,
right.
supposedly
exactly.
country, but we do a lot of things in the name of exceptionalism that go against that.
Well, that and the key phrase, I couldn't pick up which one of you said it was.
That was Frank Thomas.
The one that said the rules don't apply to us.
Yes.
And that is the key difference. And I've been around exceptional people, people who are really smart, really capable. But the ones who always stand out for me are the ones who are confident enough in who they are that they don't think they have to have a different set of rules.
Mm-hmm.
That they work with other, that their strength, whether it's intelligence, athletic, but whatever it is, they make the people around them better by working with them and recognizing that, not saying that, hey, the cool thing about being me is I don't have to do what all the rest of you people have to do.
Well, that's clearly
that's
Romney's policy, right? That's what Romney
right.
lives off. He doesn't, well, he doesn't release his tax returns, and everyone else has put out 10, 12 years of tax returns because he doesn't have to play by your rules.
By you people.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard right. not to see the connection between this philosophy and the way Romney grew up. He grew up in a world completely unlike the rest of us. And I forget, someone wrote a column a while back that said that the big problem with Romney is he really doesn't understand how different his life has been from everybody else's.
Mm-hmm.
And it's okay to have it. It's fine. I mean, FDR grew up wealthy and did a lot of great things. A lot of people in that situation. But you can't, well, it was like when he was down in Florida when he was meeting with the unemployed people and said, hey, I'm unemployed too.
Oh, right. Yes,
yeah.
Last year.
Yeah. Not quite the same thing when you've got $400 million in the bank.
And I'm glad, sir, that you referenced FDR, because he was considered a class traitor for trying to help the less fortunate,
right.
as was Bobby Kennedy, who after his big transformation after he left the White House as Attorney General. And it seems like Mitt Romney is on the surface at least sort of prone to the same malaise that George W. Bush was. Which is there's plenty of people who are millionaires at birth who are aware and compassionate and care about the less fortunate and realize that if government helps all of us, it helps the rich too.
Mm-hmm.
I think
right.
the problem is people who have complete ignorance as to their own societal privilege. And that seems to be the place that Mitt Romney's been brought up in. I would say more, but I'm afraid he might pin me down and cut my hair.
The Republicans are always talking about, anyone in America can come up from nothing and make it. And Mitt Romney did, take a few million dollars and turned it into $250 million. But he started with a leg up,
and he
doesn't seem to acknowledge that.
I think John Calipari had a great quote about people like that where he said, some people are not everyone's born on third base. Some people were born outside of the stadium.
Yes,
and we
got
to take care of the people who were born outside of the stadium.
Well, Congressman, this is why I was so inspired by the Democratic convention, because it really seems to be more and more that I think the Democrats have, if you look at the last 25 years, become the party of fiscal responsibility.
Yeah, well, we have a cohesive message about economic opportunity for all. And how to balance that. And then I'm glad you mentioned the fiscal responsibility thing, because the Republicans keep complaining about the deficit, and then, the Romney-Ryan proposal would only increase the deficit, because they want to keep defense spending as high as it's been.
Mm-hmm.
They want to cut taxes further, even beyond extending the Bush tax cuts. They want to cut them further than that, and won't talk about what they're going to cut. So, yeah, I think we had a clear economic plan. We want to create economic opportunity for a broad base of people. Fiscal responsibility has to be part of that, but opportunity has to be part of it as well. I thought the convention went great. I'm sorry that we didn't have an 82-year-old actor at the end there to really bring it home for us in an unscripted, incoherent 12-minute essay. You can't have everything.
Well,
we did our best.
And again, that goes back to Mr. Fernsterman and Mr. Romney's messaging people. It's just this is what Rupert Murdoch criticized mm-hmm. about the campaign. Congressman Smith, it is great to have you here and to talk about fiscal responsibility, because we saw Bill Clinton work with Republicans. A compromise was made where the rich paid a slight tax increase. We had
right.
balanced budgets every year and a very healthy surplus. We don't hear that at all. And as we discussed earlier with Congressman Yarmouth, it seems like the Republicans have really become guilty of being the very irresponsible fiscal politicians that they accuse Democrats of being. Instead of tax and spend, it's just borrow and spend. And I look
right.
at the Democrats and I see Barack Obama having the smallest rate of government of government growth in history, of paying off these wars, of actually putting the wars into the budget, and, you know, and wanting the rich to pay a fair tax rate, where a guy working, a middle-class teacher who makes 24 grand a year, I mean, who pays 24% of their taxes, whereas Mitt Romney only pays 14%. That's not conservative, nor is it sane.
No, I think we've got the better of the argument. Certainly, President Clinton has helped. We just got to bring it home and make sure we deliver that argument consistently, because, you know, we've been mindful of the fact that the economy is still not where any of us want it to be. And we're going to have to make the case that we've got plans for the next 4 years that are going to put us in a better place than the Republicans would put us. I mean, I don't think it's debatable that we're better off than we were 4 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I find it odd that the Republicans went down that road. I mean, in January of 2009, the stock market was at like 6,600. We were losing 800,000 jobs a month, and the economy was contracting at a rate of 6%. We are better off.
Indeed.
The question is, who's got the plan, who's going to get us to the place that we want to be? Who's in a better position to do that? And I think clearly President Obama is. We just got to deliver that message.
I was very surprised to hear Governor Romney, I believe in Virginia Beach yesterday, discussing the tragedy of income inequality and how the gap between rich and poor has never been wider. That's the sort of thing that gets Democrats accused of class warfare, and I can only imagine how the GOP establishment felt hearing Mitt Romney use that phrase.
Well, I think he's belatedly waking up to the fact that middle-class economic opportunity is the key message in this race. Now, it's odd that that didn't occur to them before they had their convention. That seemed like the better moment to try to roll it out. But, you know, they are at least beginning to understand that's an issue, and they have to at least talk about it. Fortunately, you know, for us, they don't really talk about it very well and certainly don't have any plans to try to bring it about.
Congressman, what can Americans do who want to make a difference? Besides just going to their polling place and voting, what can people do?
Well, you know, get out, talk to your neighbors. I mean, grassroots politics is basic grassroots politics, and that's, you know, help out the campaign, knocking on doors, passing out literature. That stuff really does matter, because once you get to the point where you've spent literally $1 billion on television ads, people are looking for something a little more personal. And if a friend or a neighbor that they respect says, hey, you know, I think this is what you ought to do, that can actually have a greater impact than most people realize.
You know, Adam Smith, it's ironic that you bear the same name as the godfather of conservative economic theory, because in The Wealth of Nations, Adam Smith in 1776 argued for progressive taxation on the wealthy.
That's the thing that people don't understand about my namesake there. He actually would have absolutely been a progressive Democrat.
Well,
capitalism is the best system for the economy, but if you don't have some sort of collective action, if you don't have government trying to make sure that it's fair, it just doesn't work. And he actually wrote that.
It's not me or we, it's me and we. We're all in this together, and I thank you so much for all that you do to help the working families of America. Congressman Adam Smith, everybody.
Thank you very much. I appreciate
it. Thank you, sir. Have a great weekend. Boy, we get the smart people here on the show.
Yeah,
I just, this is just so great for Stephanie. I'm going to be back in New York having meth heads yell at me on the sidewalk next week. We'll be taking your calls. Katrina Vandenheuvel of The Nation. It's like the IQ is exploding today. We'll be right back after this on The Stephanie Miller Show.
Hey, a freak show.
It's The Stephanie Miller Show.
And your mama takes a shine to her best son. Something different. Oh, the girls that seem to like you. Cause you're handsome, like you're talking a whole lot of fun.
This is the Stephanie Miller Show, and you are listening to the Scissor Sisters. This is a mashup with the Beatles, I think, with For No One, but it takes a while for the Beatles to pop into this one. I'm John Fugelsang, filling in for Steph all week long. Really happy to take your calls at 1-800-STEPH-12. I'm joined by the great Frank Conniff, TV's Frank, right here in the studio. Comedian Trevon Free, Tony Sorrentino on the mic. We're so happy you're with us. Been a pretty smart day today so far. We've had two congressmen. It's been... We believe in the yin-yang intellectual principles here at the Stephanie Miller Show.
I get to go home and tell people I talked to congressmen today.
Yeah, well, I want to talk about the medical marijuana issue really briefly now. Tony, do we have that cut of Paul Ryan, what he said to the Colorado radio station? Have a listen.
Look, my personal position on these issues have been let the states decide what they want to do with these things. This is something that is not a high priority of ours.
Mistake! That was then walked back by the Romney campaign, who now says that Paul Ryan believes that people with cancer who smoke pot deserve to be in prison. So I wanted to play this clip. We played this yesterday. It's only a minute long, and I think it speaks a lot to who Mitt Romney is as a man. You can find this clip on YouTube. This is a very sick individual in a wheelchair, weighs under 100 pounds. This was in 2007 during the Ryan campaign. And this guy apparently went after Romney a few times, but this is the first time. And I want you to listen very carefully to what the patient tells Mitt Romney and asks about what he should do since synthetic marijuana makes him sick, and how Romney will not answer his question. Tony, let's hear it.
And I have to take medication or I'll die. Right now I weigh less than 80 pounds. I have all my life. I have support of five of my doctors saying that I am living proof that medical marijuana works. I am completely against legalizing it for everyone, but there is medical purpose for it.
And you have synthetic marijuana that's available and other pain medication.
It makes me sick. I have tried it and it makes me throw up. I have tried all the medications there are and all the forms that come in after high stimulators or steroids. I have muscular dystrophy that's completely against my DNA.
I'm sorry to hear
my, that. My question for you is, will you arrest me and my doctors if I get medical marijuana?
I'm not in favor of medical marijuana being
so
legal.
Will you
in the
have
country?
Me arrested?
Hi.
Excuse me.
Walks away.
I'm sorry.
Now listen.
Wait, are you not going to answer his question, Governor?
I think I have. I'm not.
No, he asked you if you were going to arrest. He asked if you were going to arrest patients like him, Governor. You're going to just ignore a person in a wheelchair?
I spoke with him.
I know, but he didn't answer his question. All right.
Hi, how are you? And he walks right away. Rick, you're calling from Spokane, Washington, about medical marijuana for veterans. Did you hear that clip we just played?
I sure did. Good morning, John.
Good morning. What's your comment, Rick? Thanks for calling.
Yeah, you know, it's really depressing and distressing when we see so many veterans who are returning from the Middle East with combat stressors committing suicide at a rate of 28 a day. When a very
I believe it's 18 a day. Is it? I don't think it's 28 a day.
Some of the numbers that we saw from the Veterans Administration as of the last study of March 26th, those numbers were only from six states reporting.
Okay, thank you. Well,
you're
please
welcome.
Continue.
But what we do see is that there can be a very, very effective aid to this rash of suicides. We've seen that veterans who are enrolled in states that have medical cannabis programs are showing significant improvement in their quality of life and their reduction of the harmful toxic medications that they're being pushed down their throats. Yeah, the opiate addiction right now is over the top.
Mm-hmm. Indeed, and that's the thing, is like you have a pill or a plant, and that's the argument that I've heard a lot of the medical marijuana advocates say, that, you know, it's not a drug until Pfizer makes it into a little white pill.
Right.
Well, the problem is the U.S. government currently holds two patents on neuropathic pain transmitters. They've awarded the rights of development to a private company, and they're in the process of developing synthetics.
Mm-hmm.
If synthetics are not effective, you have a natural plant that is simply harvested and dried.
Right on. Yes, and that's where the essence of the argument, morally and legally. Rick, I thank you so much for the call. I say if it helps our veterans in their recovery, I think it's unpatriotic to keep it from them.
Why would what's the logic behind synthetic marijuana being okay but not regular marijuana?
Exactly. We'll cover that when we come back, because there's a point that Barack Obama made recently I want to play for you as well. This is the Stephanie Miller Show. I'm John Fugelsang in the last half hour of the show. We're taking your calls at 1-800-STEPH-12. We are on your radio. We are on Current TV. Big documentary for Pierce tonight, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. Stephanie Miller Show. You're listening to The Clash and the Killers, mashed up in an unholy alchemy. It's been a real pleasure to fill in for Stephanie all week. The documentary on the Sexy Liberal Comedy Tour premieres tonight on Current TV at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. And I'm really thrilled to welcome our next guest. I first had the honor of meeting this woman on a TV show I did for CNBC a few years back. And you really can't talk about Sexy Liberal without bringing up Katrina Vandenhuvel, editor of The Nation. Good morning, Katrina. Welcome to the Stephanie Miller Show.
Good morning. You may want to hang out with my husband and my cat. They may take issue with your description, but I love Stephanie Miller's self-description in her tour, and I hope it goes very well.
It should. It's been going very well. Thank you. We hope to get you to maybe come see our show at the Beacon at the end of the month.
Oh, that's right. I'm around that area all the time. I saw it's coming. This is great.
So I'm only doing the tour because my whole goal in comedy is to eventually break into being a comic on the Nation Cruise. That's really getting that many cool people on a boat at once sounds like my dream audience because they can't leave.
It's pretty wild.
Yeah, well, I have to congratulate you because The Nation did something that I really loved last week or 2 weeks ago now. You had the People's Platform, your version of what the Democratic Party platform could be at the launch of the DNC, and it was a really inspiring issue. I recommend everyone check it out. What inspired you to put that together?
Thank you, John. I mean, part of our work and part of how we all, I think, approach our political life these days is, you know, we're working with what we have, but we're always trying to build a more fair, more just society. And I think it was rooted in that idea that while the Democratic platform has moved in a direction that, you know, arc of history toward justice with the full embrace of LGBT rights, that's a long time coming and a lot of struggle and organizing by Dreamers, by the immigration rights movement. On the immigration rights plank, we still felt that there needed to be a more boldly progressive direction. So we came up with these planks, but we also put it on thenation.com and solicited other ideas from readers, from our community. And I just feel we need to think, how do we build a different kind of society, even while we work in the world we live in and try to ensure that we don't get pummeled too much and we're not overtaken by extremist right-wing forces.
Exactly.
But we can't lose sight of what we want to build.
Well, I wanted to ask you, what has inspired you more in the last 2 weeks, the DNC's convention or Mitt Romney's efforts at foreign policy? What has made you more enthusiastic about Barack Obama?
You know, Mitt Romney's response to what has happened in Egypt and Libya was so appalling, was so reckless, was so risky, and so aggressive. It showed a man, and a party, by the way, and advisors, who see the world in black and white, who seem prepared to go to war, who seem prepared to ignore that even in their own party, there's not much enthusiasm among people exhausted by two wars that this country has fought over the last 10, 12 years.
Amen.
To go back into that morass. But you have the same people, John, around Romney, who took us into one of the greatest foreign policy national security disasters of this country's history, not to minimize the thousands and thousands of Iraqi civilians whose lives were destroyed in that war. But just on the U.S. side, we are not more secure as a result of that war. And when we talk about the deficit and debt, as the Republican Party does ceaselessly,
when a Democrat's in office, they do, Katrina.
It's pathetic, you know, and you know, I mean, it's two unfunded wars, it's Bush tax cuts, of course, it's the financial crisis, and it's Medicare
D and all of that.
But I think what we saw with Mitt Romney is a man who, in my view, and I believe in the view of some serious Republicans, seems unfit to hold the office of president, if that office includes being commander-in-chief, which last I checked, it does.
Mm-hmm. I think you're right. He lost Peggy Noonan this week. I mean, how far did
he
have to go?
Matthew Dowd is someone I've done TV with occasionally on ABC this week. He said Sarah Palin must be advising Mitt Romney. This is amateur. I mean, and it's not, you know, I laugh too, but then you think of the risks, the danger.
Mm-hmm.
There was a wonderful letter in the New York Times today that by a professor of law at Columbia Law School. He said Mitt Romney's response to the killings in Libya reminded us again of the wisdom of Napoleon's warning that, quote, the man who will say anything will do anything.
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah. And this is exactly why, you know, one of the reasons why I support the president's reelection so firmly, that the fact that Ruth Bader Ginsburg is 131 years old. You know, and
well, let me just, if I might on that front,
please.
This taped a Bill Moyers show, which is airing on Sunday night, about our special issue of next week called the 1% Court. And in it, we begin the show talking about the ages of some of the justices. You know, Ruth Bader Ginsburg is 79. She's not 100 and something, but she's, you know, she's an extraordinary justice, but she
Indeed.
Is in frail health. And what, you know, we do focus on the court, progressives focus on the court for good reason around social policy, about abortion rights, critical issues like that. But what this issue really looks at is how this court has empowered the 1% at the expense of the 99%, that the powerful have their thumbs all over this court while the working people of this country are getting the shaft from this court. You know, it's favoring management versus labor. It's impeding
exactly.
access to the courts for ordinary people. It's shielding financial institutions from accountability. And, of course, in its Citizens United decision of 2010, it allowed the unleashing of a flood of corporate money into an already polluted political system, which takes me back, if I might, to our platform, because so many of the issues we brought up, like a democratic media, a democratic politics, a regulation of the banks, or Medicare for all, these are connected to the money in our politics. There's a reason we don't have some of these reforms or the reforms that President Obama fought for.
Even though the public want
exactly.
those things are all popular.
Exactly.
The public option
exactly.
is popular with the public.
Yep.
The Congress and the courts
yeah.
are not.
It wasn't,
right.
But it wasn't popular with Joe Lieberman, and that's
right.
why we're not going to have it.
And they're not. What the public cares for is not important to these people.
Well, the danger is the more and more that the scales are tipped toward the super PACs, the secret money, the undisclosed money, people's voices will get shouted down and shut off. And
well, we saw it happen this year because conservatives' voices were the first ones to be truly silenced by Citizens United when Governor Romney steamrolled the Santorum and Gingrich campaigns in the primary states.
Right.
Ironically, Republican
yeah.
voters were the
yeah.
first ones to be disenfranchised by Citizens
that's
United.
True.
And that's true.
I also see the power of money in what I think is one of the most serious problems and issues in this election, which is voter suppression.
Yes.
I mean, in many ways, this is an election, first of all, that's being fought in about 8 states. It's not being fought nationally, as some of the polls, you know, lead people to think. But it's really about get out the vote versus voter suppression. What kind of political party bets its future on suppressing the vote rather than expanding the vote?
Exactly.
The Republican Party. And I think that's a measure of an anti-democratic inclination of a party that looks out at this country, sees how it's changing demographically, that there are new coalitions, the young, people of color,
and they don't
want to let those voices surface, and so the money they're pouring in is part of that suppression, as is the voter suppression.
You're right.
And Katrina, let me just throw in, as a Black American, I'm extremely disgusted with the voter ID laws and the voter suppression that's taken place, because especially the fact that no one is really fighting hard enough to call these people out on what they're doing.
Well,
and they're,
progressive media is.
Well, yeah, I mean, on a scale that something happens where things are starting to backtrack. I mean, I've seen some stuff where some of these places the laws are actually being put into effect. And it's kind of disturbing that it's even an issue that they could happen in 2012.
Mm-hmm.
That
it got a huge round of applause at the Republican convention.
Yeah, the governor
yeah.
Nikki Haley, right?
Yeah.
She brought it up, and it's like, how far have we come?
And again, it's not a problem. We do not have a problem with people voting who are not registered.
Both of you know, I mean, you're more likely to be struck by lightning right now or see a unicorn than to really experience instances of voter fraud. No, really. I mean, there was a Bush Administration Department of Justice report. I think they found 8 cases. You know, they surveyed thousands and thousands. But what's happened is, very cleverly, and I don't say that in a positive way, the Republicans have placed and have elected these governors in key states who are ramming these things through. And it is the case that there's not enough of a fight, but you're seeing legal action. The key is to link it to the community organizing progressive action. And I think this White House, not vocally enough, but
that's,
has spoken
that's what
out.
I was getting at. I think
yeah.
it's such a, it feels like to me, it's such a bigger deal than it's being made of by the White House. I think it's not being made a big enough deal is what I mean to say by the White House, because you're talking about a voter rights act that happened, what,
in 60,
50, almost 50 years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
And people are actively trying to reverse those laws.
And the next step, by the way, talking about the Supreme Court, we have a reporter looking at this. There is a well-funded think tank, financial and other kind of right-wing infrastructure poised to target, gut, and destroy the Voting Rights Act.
Yes.
By gutting the, is it Section 5, the section that is so critical to the implementation and strength of the Voting Rights Act. That is the goal. In the meantime, what we're witnessing are skirmishes leading up to that. And so I think the courts, the good news is many of the court decisions in these key states have gone in the right way. You know, to be honest with you, I don't know if the strategy of the administration is to not speak too much, sort of carry a big stick,
but be
quiet. Because I think the Department of Justice has a lot of action going on this front.
And also,
I
was just going to say that if I think Obama is probably careful about the more that he speaks up about this, the more the right wing is going to portray him as being uptight because the more he gives him the opportunity to demonize him. Mm-hmm. And I think, like you're saying, it's like the small stick. Because the courts are having some success, fighting back some of this stuff.
I agree on a lot.
And you know, I also think what's important, let's be honest. I mean, we have a project here at The Nation, at thenation.com called Voting Rights Watch. It's in partnership with Color Lines. I think part of the strategy is also that this should not be a partisan issue. Why should it? I mean, this is about democracy. It's about expanding democracy. That has been the curve of justice that this country is committed to.
But if you expand democracy, the Republicans lose.
Right. if the president makes a big deal of it, it does become or looks like more of a partisan issue, when in fact it should be a pro-democracy issue.
Mm-hmm. You're right.
And that's where, you know, we've had... I've looked into this a little because of the Citizens United fight, and so many people say, oh, it's just quixotic to think impossible to fight for an amendment. Well, the right wing has mobilized around amendments over the years, and we've had 17 amendments since the Bill of Rights, and they have been franchise expanding, democracy defending. Mm-hmm. And I think what we're witnessing, as both of you have said so eloquently, is basically a Republican Party, committed to repealing and rolling back the civilizing advances of the 20th and the beginning of the 21st century. And the key to that, in many ways, was voting rights.
Yes. But here's the silver lining, I think, Katrina. Tell me if you agree. The silver lining to all this rolling back the voter rights is that it's clearly a sign that the right-wing aristocracy status quo is scared. And they know they're getting smaller, and they know the minorities that make up the majority of this country are eventually going to be able to take democracy back from aristocracy.
Right.
I think that all of this voter suppression we're seeing and these attempts to actually let less people vote in a democracy are signs that the right-wing base is really scared that they're not going to have the power to win honestly anymore, because there's just less of them every year.
I agree, but I think on some level what we're witnessing in 2012 is the kind of last hurrah of a party that is increasingly pale, stale, older, very southernized, but even the New South is more diverse than this Republican Party.
Yep.
But in the last hurrah, the ability to pour in millions and millions to outspend truth, and then combine that with the ability, if the courts don't go in the right way in many places, to suppress the vote, they could have a last hurrah in this season.
You're right.
I think, as I said, looking out, you know, in 2042, I believe this country will be majority-minority. And this country's already changing. So the most benign kind of interpretation of the Tea Party and the elements around it is that they are nostalgic for a country that in many ways never existed, or a country that really was bigoted, was not true to the greatest ideals of America, and they are trying to stay there. But you can't, because you're on the wrong side of history.
They cling to an Eisenhower America that existed under Eisenhower, who had massive federal spending and taxed the wealthy at a very high rate.
I know, right? Eisenhower, 90% marginal tax rates.
Amnesia,
right? And the military-industrial complex.
Interstate highway bill and that socialist GI Bill, too. Katrina, it's such an honor to have you on the show. I got to tell you, every year when my dad was alive, he would get me a subscription to National Catholic Reporter, and I would get him a subscription to The Nation. And I think that your magazine is one of the finest gifts you can give to a loved one, a child or a parent anytime. And I thank you for all you do for democracy. And thanks for coming
thank
on the show
you.
Today.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
All righty then. We're going to go to break right now. Boy, I love her. She's just
so
smart.
She's awesome.
You know, like they said, Seinfeld surrounded himself with people that were better actors than him to look good. I do that with intelligence, and it's working out. So we'll be taking your calls in the waning minutes. We're going to try to get to everybody, and as likewise, we're going to play the one controversial Barack Obama marijuana clip that I want you all to hear. Mm-hmm. It's the Stephanie Miller Show. I'm John Fiegel saying this is Current TV. We'll be right back.
I love it. It's a fabulous program.
It's the Stephanie Miller Show.
Stephanie Miller Show with John Fiegelsang. I want to play this really funny Barack Obama campaign ad that's a little bit controversial. I'm here with, of course, Trevon Free and Frank Conniff and Tony Sorrentino on the mic. Tony, let's hear this new Obama 2012 ad.
Hey, this is Barack.
He's
Listen,
on the
I
phone.
I need to know if you're on board. Okay, good. Because I'm counting on you. Everybody is. We have to get this right. So there's a lot at stake here. Just remember that I'm trusting you on this, and I'll see you there.
Pull out, and it's Cal Penn and John Cho as Harold and Kumar on a couch.
Dude, who was that? Sounded intense. The president. Sweet.
This got a lot of marijuana advocates angry because, as we know, this president has cracked down ferociously on the dispensaries in California, and yet here he is seemingly going for the two icons of the modern Cheech and Chong of millennial
Doesn't
pot comedy.
It seem like legalizing drugs would be a very popular thing, and the politicians are just, it's another one of those things where they're just out of touch with.
Well, for a while, they were saying that was going to be his October surprise.
Well, it would help the economy, and he has suggested in his second term he would revisit drug policy, but I think this is one of the reasons why so many young people are drawn to the Ron Paul campaign, because it's the modern drug war.
Because you have to be high to like him.
The drug war has failed. It has turned law-abiding citizens into criminals. It has led to corruption. It's helping one group only, the prison industrial complex.
Yes.
And it's helping a lot of politicians get reelected. Gene, you're calling from California about medical marijuana. Good morning.
Good morning, John.
What a pleasure.
Excuse me?
What a pleasure. Thank you.
What a pleasure. I'm out here in California, and we have kind of different laws. I want to let you know that I'm a 64-year-old artist, and my husband is 77, and we've been medical marijuana patients for quite some time. I'm also, my art involves marijuana. So I'm very involved. Nice. I've been very
So you play
active.
Reggae?
How does your art involve marijuana? Do you actually you paint with hemp, or do you paintings about marijuana?
I do. Well, I work with Photoshop, and
okay.
I have.
But without a
of,
computer.
With that, I have millions of pictures of gardens all over
over
California, and I use those, and I turn them into fine art, and I've turned them into. Fabric, and
so
I've turned them into
Are your prices
cartoons.
High?
Excuse me?
So he wondered if your prices
fabric,
were high.
Right.
He's being a wise guy. Gene,
well, let me tell you, my husband and I would not do very well in prison.
Well, we only have a minute left, but I wanted so you'll soon be a senior. Your husband is a senior, and you both use medical marijuana. Has it had positive health benefits for you?
It has definitely helped us.
How has it helped you?
It's not OxyContin.
Right.
It's something that, you know,
That's
so
such
many
a great
people
point.
Are hooked on for mm-hmm. for pain, and marijuana does the trick. And I want to tell you that it's not the big deal that everybody's making it.
Right
if you look at the history, it was political from the get-go.
Yep. Well, I thank you for the call, Gene. It's true. Hey, look, Lincoln smoked it. He wrote his letter to the Herner Harmonica Company president saying he enjoyed playing his harmonica, playing his sweet hemp pipe. And you know what? If your wife was a crazy shopping addict, you probably would have to indulge in that, too.
My only experience with medical marijuana back when I used to smoke was when I would get high and watch Marcus Welby.
Well, that's a bit too racy for me, you and your drug gangs. It has been a real pleasure filling in this entire week. I'm sorry we didn't get to all the calls. We got to most of you today. It's been my sublime honor filling in for Steph. I'm with Hal Sparks in Madison, Wisconsin on October 6th for an election special. Sexy Liberal Comedy Tour will be in Seattle end of the month on Saturday the 29th, and we'll be looking forward to you. Follow Trevon Free and Frank Conniff on Twitter. The documentary premieres tonight on Current TV at 9 p.m. Folks, have a great weekend. God bless America.